Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Hudson, the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends, a Wall Street financial analyst, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire, Trade, Development, and Foreign Debt, and The Myth of Aid. Michael acts as an economic advisor to governments worldwide, including Iceland, Latvia, and China, on finance and tax laws. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hudson.
Thank you very much.
And you have an article in the German paper, Frankfurter Zeitung, Europe's Transition from Social Democracy to Oligarchy. And frankly, I've been puzzled for some time over the last couple of years interviewing economists about what's happening in Europe and the apparent inability of the Europeans to get their hands around the euro crisis. The more they delay and waffle, the higher the price of bailouts become. And the economist Rob Johnson pointed out to me that there may be another agenda here, and that is that members of the European elite want to break the social contracts, the social democracy in Europe, in order to be more competitive in this new globalized economy. So just as we in America are becoming more like Bangladesh, the hope amongst the European elite is that their workers will become more like Bangladesh. And it's a long question, I know, but now your new article reinforces that.
Well, I think that Rob Johnson is correct. There is a big neoliberal push in Europe. What is so surprising is that it's the socialist parties, the social democrats, and the labor parties that are leading the anti-labor move to the far right of the political spectrum. It's the labor parties and the social democrats that are standing up for the banks and insisting that taxes be levied much more highly on labor to pay the banks. And this is turns upside down everything that social democracy and the labor party stood for a century ago. The situation is by far the worst in Iceland, where they had a labor and green prime minister that is enforced such stringent reduction in living standards, such an awful giveaway to the vulture banks, that 10% of the Icelandic population have had to emigrate to live in Norway and other countries because there's no work. Germany and in Greece, it was the Socialist Party that led the movement to the far right, saying we have to cut wages by 50%. It was the conservatives that opposed this. It was the socialists. In fact, the Greek president is the president of the Socialist International, who said we've got to pay the banks by taking it out of labor. We cannot tax the rich. We cannot tax property. We cannot tax land. We must reduce wages. And this is hard for foreign observers to realize. And you have very much the same situation in the post-Soviet economies. So all of the concepts of right and left of the political spectrum have been turned upside down by the fact that the left wing supports the banks and is the most neoliberal, the most anti-labor of all. They're almost as anti-labor as Obama and the Democrats are in the United States.
Well, it was the Democrats, after all, who voted for the TARP bailout, and the Republicans didn't. You recall the first vote went down, and the financial establishment and the Treasury Secretary and then President Bush and Nancy Pelosi all panicked and managed to persuade everybody on the second TARP vote to give away all this money to Wall Street. So arguably what you're describing in Europe also exists here. But my understanding about Iceland was that, first of all, it was the British and the Dutch banks that opened amazing amounts of accounts in Iceland, which were far exceeded the number of people, mostly British depositors and Dutch depositors. That whole thing was so absurd from the surface. That was the beginning of the unraveling, wasn't it?
In a way, yes, but the British depositors and Dutch had their deposits in British banks and Dutch banks that happened to be owned by Icelanders in conjunction with Russian criminals and other sort of underworld figures. So it's a myth that the Icelandic people were in any way liable to bail out Copthing and Icesave and these banks. These are purely British banks And Gordon Brown was trying to cover his own incompetence and the incompetence of the British Financial Services Agency by trying to blame the Icelanders. What's much worse is that after the Icelandic banks went bankrupt, they were sold to a group of vulture bankers, including apparently the owners of the earlier banks, for about 10 cents on the dollar. And the agreement was that buyers of these banks would scale down the bad real estate loans and other loans by 90% also to the same proportion. They haven't done that, and the Social Democratic and Green government says that's okay. Not only do they say that the vulture banks can collect the full amount, and this is for a country that's in much more negative equity here, but Iceland has a indexation of the bank loan, the principal, and the interest to the consumer price index, which means the foreign exchange rate. Now, this is illegal under the Constitution, but the government, the socialist government, has retroactively said, well, we're changing the laws so that the vulture banks can get paid even more. This has led to the government there having only an 8% approval rating. It's even lower than Obama's here. Yet they're saying, we're in power, we're not going to give up. We're here to give essentially our backers, the banks, everything they want, and Iceland was viewed as a kind of test case, along with Latvia, that led the Europeans to think, well, wait a minute, if we can cut their GDP by 30%, if we can cut their wages by 50%, and in Latvia, if we can cut the public sector wages by 30%, and essentially shift the tax on the labor off property, why can't we do it throughout all of Europe, Greece, Spain, Italy? And so the class war is back in business, but in this case, the class war against labor is being led by the left-wing parties. And there doesn't seem to be any solution to this. You wouldn't expect the Republicans here to really stand up against other banks. They voted against TARP only when they saw that the Democrats were voting so strongly for it that they could make a populist pretense at opposing the banks. But if it really would have been important to pass the law, you can be sure the Republicans would have jumped on board just as badly as the Democrats
sure.
did, because they know where their campaign funding is coming
from. Well, but they were much, tactically and politically, they were much cleverer, because out of that was born the Tea Party, where the right captured outrage over Wall Street instead of the left, who should have owned that issue. Again, I'm speaking with Michael Hudson, the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. He's a Wall Street financial analyst and professor of economics. Your article in the Frankfurter Zeitung, Europe's Transition from Social Democracy to Oligarchy. By the way, isn't that a Christian Democratic newspaper?
Yes.
That's so Merkel's party.
Yes, and you can see that within the Christian Democratic Party, well, first of all, this is the largest newspaper in Germany. It's one of the Germany has only two national papers, and this is one of them, and this is the mainstream conservative paper. And what this shows is that even within the Christian Democrats and the center parties there, there's a reaction against neoliberalism. And the neoliberals are now mainly on the left wing of the spectrum. And the conservatives are saying, wait a minute, this is going to, it's all very well to increase profits and investment, but if we bankrupt the consumers, there's not going to be anybody to buy what we're producing, and it's suicidal.
Well, it has echoes of your article and what you reveal, Michael Hudson, has echoes of Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, crisis capitalism. You say, under the political umbrella of financial emergency, wages and living standards are to be scaled back and political power shifted from elected governments to technocrats governing on behalf of large banks and financial institutions. Public sector labor is to be privatized and deunionized, while Social Security, pension plans and health insurance are scaled back. Now, the big difference, of course, between the Europeans and the Americans is that the Europeans actually have a social safety net. They have full health care, pregnancy leave, child care, you name it. We have very little. What we have here, Social Security, Medicare, the Republicans are trying to dismantle. My understanding, though, is, and it's pathetic over here to think that the debates that are going on now, with the, in particular in South Carolina, with the Republicans and their campaign, will be against health care. In this country, you can actually successfully argue against health care. It's an extraordinary difference. But in Europe, whenever the governments threaten their social safety net, the people take to the streets. So what's not happening?
I don't think people here have any idea what's in store for them. And that's why I focus so much on Latvia and Iceland as dress rehearsals for what's going to happen here as well as in Europe. The basic financial position is you don't know how far you can push wages and living standards down until people push back. And nobody's pushing back here. At least when the Greeks all went out in the general strike, that showed that no matter what the government agreed to pay Europe, that the agreement was not made with democratic approval. And that means that when another government comes in, presumably the conservative government, which over the weekend said that it was not going to go along with the austerity program and would not go along with the privatization sell-offs, that means only the socialists want to privatize. Only the socialists want to reduce labor. That means that when they come in, they will say, this debt is an odious debt. It was done by bribery or whatever, but the government that signed the debt did not represent the Greek people. You Europeans could all turn on your television and you could see the demonstrators in the street saying, we oppose this. Same thing in Spain, same thing in Italy. You have in the wings the conservative parties waiting to come in and repudiate the debts. Who would have thought?
Well, Michael Hudson, just in today's news, of course, is somewhat perplexing. You know, just recently, the third rating agency, Standard & Poor's, downgraded a lot of European debt, except for the Germans, the French, the Dutch, the Austrians. Austria, of course, is owed an enormous amount of money by Hungary. The Dutch, of course, that's a big surprise. Yet the financial news today indicates that all European stocks are up. So explain that.
I can't explain why the stock market is going up, except that there's so much money around that nowhere else to go. The stock market, the effect of Standard & Poor's downgrading. First of all, Standard & Poor is on an ultra-right-wing Tea Party ideology. They are trying to downgrade governments to force governments essentially to take a right-wing policy. When they downgrade, this means that institutional investors, such as pension funds and mutual funds, are legally not allowed to hold the debt of these countries. Now, if you have billions of dollars of funds invested in government bonds that are downgraded, this money has to be invested somewhere else. And so I think they're going to shift out of the bond market into the stock market, which would explain why the stock market has gone up today. Meanwhile, this has lowered the price of bonds, letting vulture funds, who are the main backers of the rating agencies here, letting vulture funds come in and grab bonds at a discount to come in later and demand austerity. So what you're doing is you're having economic and financial policy pass out of the hands of elected representatives into the hands of the bankers. And what they call a free market is centralized planning in the hands of bankers. The key thing to realize is that the people who talk about the free market want a much more centralized economy, even than Stalinism. But they want to centralize the economy in the hands of the banks and the 1% of the population, not in the form of government. And they fight government because that's the only power that's able to regulate and tax them. So the free marketers are the hyper-centralizers politically of our day. That was the aim of the article that I wrote, which is, by the way, in English, it's on my website, michael-hudson.com.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Hudson, the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. He's also a Wall Street financial analyst, a professor of economics, and an advisor to governments worldwide, including Iceland, Latvia, and China, on finance and tax laws. Of course, the U.S., I think, started this other trend, which is the transfer of private debt into public debt. That's what happened in 2008, where the profligacy and recklessness of Wall Street ended up, the taxpayer ended up having to bail them out. And I think it's the record amount of private debt that was turned into public debt. The Levy Institute did a study saying that the Fed put up $29 trillion to stabilize the Wall Street and the global economy.
They're counting all the transactions.
Sure.
Randy Ray, who did that calculation.
Right.
And he's a colleague of mine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He added up, what happened was the Fed refused to say how much money it had actually printed and given to the bank. So Bloomberg Financial, that the mayor of New York controls, brought a lawsuit to find out. And Randy added up the sum of all of the debts that were made. All of the bonds and junk securities that were taken onto the Fed's balance sheet, and that was $29 billion. But many of these were refinancings, and I think the net was about $13 trillion. So, in effect, claiming to fight the government spending and fighting the government debt, you had the neoliberals, the free marketers, vastly increase the government debt as they did under Reagan.
So whether it was $29 trillion or $13 trillion, it's still, compared to what the European Central Bank has put up to rescue the euro and shore up the bond market attacking sovereign debt, it's pathetic. It's about $1 trillion, isn't it?
What do you mean? It's all
well, in other words, they don't have a Federal Reserve in Europe at any rate, but my understanding...
That's right. They're not able to. The bank succeeded in blocking governments from financing themselves and doing what a central bank is supposed to do, from the Bank of England to the Federal Reserve here. They say, no, the governments have to pay us interest for creating credit on our computer keyboards that the government could do just as well on its computer keyboards. So they've said the hallmark of democracy is oligarchy, basically. The hallmark of democracy is taking the central banks out of the hands of elected officials and making them independent. By independent, they mean controlled by the commercial bank lobbyists. So it's we're dealing with a kind of Orwellian rhetoric here. That is just the opposite of, you know, what basic economic and political reality is.
But you mentioned a little while ago, Michael Hudson, the right-wing Tea Party mentality, and my understanding is that there's a fear that right-wing parties will be revived in Europe, and it's already happened in Hungary, where you have under Orbán.
Well, they already have been revived. The Labour Party in England is more right-wing than almost any other party. The Labour Party in Greece is
right. But, but nobody's
the Socialist Party is way to the right. These are the right-wing parties.
No, but... believe you me, the Orbán's party in Hungary is a fascist party. Their government-endorsed thugs are running around the streets beating up gypsies and gays. The European Union has had to try and stop them from their taking over these repressive press laws. Now they're trying to take over the judiciary and all the finance institutions through the ruling party, which got a two-thirds majority. I mean, it's happening there. That has echoes of 1930 in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So is that a possibility that you know? I'm trying to get a distinction here between right-wing bankers and what happens
the right-wing fascism is coming from the left wing of the spectrum in Europe. It'll be called it's the socialist parties that are leading the ultra-right anti-labor pro-bank movement. That's the purpose of my article. That's what's so hard to understand. How on earth did it happen? How could someone like Tony Blair or Gordon Brown ever be elected as Labour Party instead of ultra-right wingers in England? How could someone like the Icelandic right winger ever be elected as a Social Democrat? How could the Papandreou in Greece ever be elected as a socialist when he's on the far right of the political spectrum? We're talking about national socialists here.
Which, of course, was the banner under which Hitler emerged.
Yes, indeed.
So just in closing then, Michael Hudson, my understanding was that much of the debate had been sort of racialized along a north-south divide, that the Germans were basically thinking that, you know, saying that the Greeks and the Spaniards and the Portuguese, et cetera, were a bunch of lazy people who didn't pay their taxes, whereas we frugal tax-paying Germans are having to foot the bill. My understanding is that
That's what the Americans say the Germans are saying. I haven't heard any Germans saying that at all.
I see.
The Germans are smart enough to look at the statistics. They know that under the UN statistics and the European government statistics, the Greeks work very, very hard. No one has said the Greeks are lazy. This is only what the American press say that the Germans say, because they don't like the Germans. But this is American anti-German racism. This is despicable. The Germans do not say this. There's no trace at all of any kind of racism there.
But Germany has clearly benefited from the euro. It's created enormous export markets for them in Europe. Isn't it pretty clear that they are resisting bailing out their southern euro partners?
Sure. Because no politician is in a position to tax its own population to support the failure of other governments to tax their rich. And the problem in Greece is there's a huge tax evasion. The Greeks were dominated by the colonels for many years that were supported by the Americans as anti-communists. And ever since, they've had essentially a very regressive tax system that taxes labor but not the rich. And there's massive tax evasion. There's supposedly 45 billion euros of Greek flight capital in Switzerland, and the European banks are asking the Greek government to sell off 50 billion euros of public property to subsidize the capital flight. And of course, that's really what it is. The criticism is over the Greek government's corruption and the inability to tax the rich. And if you don't tax the rich, if you don't have progressive taxation, you're going to have a huge budget deficit. And if you don't have a central bank to fund the government deficit, then you're going to have to tax the people. And neither Germany nor any other country in Europe is willing or can be elected if it says, well, we're going to raise taxes on you Germans to subsidize the Greek oligarchy's ability to avoid paying taxes itself. Their position is very understandable. The problem is that there's no central bank in Europe, and there's no overall tax system, and nobody's really talked about shifting the taxes back onto real estate and property, except in Greece. In Greece, they're saying, look, we've got to tax the land, because you can't hide that. We've got to go back to taxing visible wealth, not invisible wealth. And the rest of Europe is not pressing for this, so they're not helping Greece at all put its its government budget in a position to be able to pay the debt. So nobody has any scenario except for default in a month or two from Greece.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Hudson.
Okay, thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Hudson, who's the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. He's a Wall Street financial analyst and professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire, Trade, Development, and Foreign Debt, and The Myth of Aid. Michael acts as an economic advisor to governments worldwide, including Iceland, Latvia, and China, on finance and tax laws. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how come the Kingdom of Jordan has avoided the Arab Spring so far.